be a cabal. And so that brings us to the end of this lecture on breaking and joining. And yes, Neil Sedaka was right. Breaking up is hard to do, but joining back together may be even harder. So as you leave this lecture, try to get together with your friends and form a coterie, like my beer and book club, to strengthen the bonds of your friendship. This will prevent any potential schism from ever happening between your friends in the first place. See you next lecture.
Lecture 21, Some High Utility Greek and Latin Affixes.
If you remember our earlier lecture on Latin and Greek roots, you may recall that we identified three main goals. One, to explore some powerful affixes and roots that aren't covered or covered as deeply in other lectures. Two, to discuss how these prefixes, affixes, and roots combine to form words. And three, to learn a few more great target vocabulary words along the way. So with these three goals in mind, we're going to explore some more Greek and Latin roots today. But to get us started, I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to say a word three times, and then I want you to repeat it three times. So if I say dog, 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 you'll simply say dog, dog, dog. And we'll do that a couple times. And then I'll ask you a question, and I want you to say the first answer that comes to your mind. Okay, ready? Okay, so here we go. Silk, silk, silk. You say it. Silk, silk, silk. You say it. Silk, silk, silk. You say it. So, what does a cow drink? Did you say milk? Because if you did, you know that cows drink water, right? Cows give milk. They don't drink it. So if you knew the correct answer, why in the world did you blurt out milk? Well, I've done this activity many different times with many different audiences, but most folks can't help but say the word milk. In fact, I know people who've experienced this same activity before. In other words, they know exactly what's coming up, but they still can't help saying milk. I mean, I've seen their mouths. They want to say water, but the word milk just bursts forth against their will. Milk. So why is this? Well, this activity drives home an important concept we've learned before. Our minds organize words by patterns and meaning, or schema. So when I asked you to repeat silk 9 times, all the words that rhymed with silk, like ilk, bilk, and of course milk, were primed in your mental lexicon. They were sort of activated and brought to the front of your mind ready for action. In other words, the ilk pattern was already on the tip of your tongue. And then, when I asked you what cows drink, your schema for cows was activated. And what does your schema for cows include? Probably pastures, barns, and of course, milk. So I sort of tricked your brain, didn't I? I activated patterns and meaning to home in on one target word. And that's the power of using pattern and meaning together. And that's exactly why it's so helpful to examine affixes and roots to build our vocabulary knowledge. When we examine high-utility affixes and roots, like spec, meaning see, in words like spectator, speechous, and circumspect, we capitalize on the way our language and our brain work together, on how patterns and meanings come together to organize our vocabulary. Okay. Let's get started with the high-utility Latin-derived prefix you'll encounter in many words, but that I found many folks aren't often sure of. What do you think the prefix DE, D, means? Do you think D means A, remove or undo? Or B, down, out of, away from? Well, if you said A or B, you are correct. This is one reason the D prefix can be tricky. It can carry a number of different meanings. The Latin preposition, de, carries multiple meanings also. It can even mean about or concerning. But we'll focus on the meanings of remove and away from here. So, let's start with DE's meaning of remove or undo. When you defrost the car on an icy morning in December, what are you doing to the frost? Well, you're removing it, aren't you? Write defrost in your vocabulary notebook as our key word for this remove, undo sense of D. You might also want to include the following words, decaffeinate and diffuse. When you decaffeinate a drink, you are removing the caffeine. And when you diffuse a bomb, you are undoing the explosive capability of the bomb. So, D can mean remove. Now, D can also mean down, out of, away from. Write this second meaning of D down in your vocabulary notebook. And for this sense of D, I think of the word deflate. Deflate comes from the Latin deflo, which means to blow away. So when something is deflated, the air is blown away. So write down deflate as your key word for D, meaning away from or down. And draw a picture of a balloon with air going out. When a balloon deflates, where's the air going? Away from the balloon, which is going down in size. Away and down. That's a great visual. Now, let's take D out for a test drive with our first target word today, denude. Now, this is your time to turn on your morphological radar that we talked about in an earlier lecture. Remember, our morphological radar is our Latin and Greek root early warning system. So, I want you to look out for familiar affixes and roots and word parts in denude. In denude, what word parts pop out at you? Well, since we were just talking about the DE prefix, you probably nailed that one. And once we take DE off of denude, what base word are we left with? Now don't be shy, you can say it. Nude. Well guess what? Denude is a verb that means to lay bare, to strip, to make nude. You'll encounter the literal sense of laying bare in a sentence like, the hillside had been denuded of trees by clear-cut mining. Or, denude might be used in a more figurative sense of stripping something away or depriving someone or something of something important. For example, the constant criticism by the captious boss denuded the small company of its once tight-knit camaraderie. So, let's return to the etymology and morphology of denude and dig a little deeper. Now, as you probably suspected, the D in denude means away. And the nude comes from the Latin verb nudo, meaning to strip. So to remember denude in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the D meaning away and the nude and connect it to strip. When you strip something away, you make it nude. And if you remember denude this way, you won't forget it. Now make a personal connection to denude. Perhaps a time when you drove by an area devastated by a hurricane or a fire and saw an entire section of forest denuded. Write this down in your vocabulary notebook. I remember visiting the incredible Yosemite National Park in California. While I was driving into the park, I was stunned by an entire section that had been denuded of trees by a recent fire. And that's my personal connection to denude. So the prefix D means remove or down, out of, away from. Let's move on to our second high-frequency prefix, ab, A-B. Now, when you think of ab, what words spring to your mind? If you said abs as in abdominals, then you are not right. As much as it sounds like it, the prefix ab is not related to washboard stomachs, six-packs, or crunches. But ab is a prefix that will give you quite a workout, because you're likely to encounter it in a number of vocabulary words. So what do you think ab means? Well, the Latin preposition ab meant off, away. So this prefix is close in meaning to one of the DE meanings that we just explored. Our key word to help us remember ab will be absent. When you are absent from school or work, where are you? You are away and off, playing hooky, gallivanting around town, or hunkered down at home watching a movie when you should be at school doing your work. So in your vocabulary notebook, write down absent as your keyword for ab to help you remember that the ab means away or off. And how about the word abnormal? Well, abnormal combines ab, meaning off and away, and the Latin noun norma, meaning rule. So someone or something that is abnormal is away from or off of the rule or the norm. And one more ab word, abduct. Now you may remember the duck ducked root from another lecture. It means lead in words like deduct and aqueduct. So when someone abducts someone else, they literally lead them away. So how helpful can this ab prefix be? Well, let's take a look at four target words in which this ab prefix plays a big part in the meaning. As we explore these words' meanings, notice how they all include the sense of off or away. Okay, our next two target ab words are often confused. Abdicate and abnegate. What do you think abnegate means? And how is it different from abdicate? Okay, let's start with abdicate, which is more familiar for most folks. And for abdicate, let me ask you a history trivia question. When was the only time in English history that a king or queen voluntarily relinquished the throne? Well, I can tell you, it caused quite a scandal, a kerfuffle, and an imbroglio among the English establishment at the time. It was 1936, and King Edward VIII abdicated the throne to marry American socialite and divorcee Wallis Simpson. King Edward gave up the throne despite the objections of the royal family and the Church of England. So, abdicate is a verb meaning to renounce or relinquish a throne, right, power, or responsibility. Now let's look at abdicate with our morphological radar on high alert. What word parts pop out at you? Well, there's that ab prefix meaning away or off, of course. So we're left with the word part dicate. Do you see a root in there? Yes, there's a root we discussed in an earlier lecture, D-I-C, meaning speak, as in our key word, diction. So, etymologically, abdicate means to speak away, and originally meant to disown and disinherit your children. Ouch. That's a pretty harsh sense of abdicate, isn't it? In fact, it wasn't until the 1600s that abdicate began to take on the current meaning of giving up a public office or power. So to remember abdicate, visualize King Edward VIII giving a formal speech of abdication, speaking away his royal office. And write this historical connection down in your vocabulary notebook. Also, highlight the ab and D-I-C to remind you that when you give up power, you are formally saying that you want to give that crown away. So what about our other target ab word, abnegate? What do you think abnegate means? Well, abnegate is a verb meaning to deny or renounce. So you might hear of someone who lost their faith saying that they abnegated their God. Now, how can you remember this word? Well, let's take a close look at abnegate. What word parts do you see? Of course, we've got the ab prefix again, meaning away. And when you take the ab away from abnegate, what are you left with? That's right, negate, which comes from the Latin nego, to deny. So etymologically, when you abnegate, you deny something away. So make a personal connection to abnegate. Think of a time that you denied or renounced something. Can you think of a time someone said something that was wrong and you denied it? Well, you may not have known it at the time, but you abnegated that person's claim. Now, abnegate also has a second meaning. And this is where it gets a little tricky. Get this. Abnegate can also mean to relinquish power. Man, that sounds just like abdicate, doesn't it? So abdicate and abnegate can both mean to relinquish power. So what's the difference? Well, according to vocabulary.com, abdicate is usually reserved for offices of higher power. So you're more likely to hear of a queen abdicating the throne and a project manager abnegating responsibility. Wow, that's a lot of power and responsibility we've been casting off or away with abdicate and abnegate, huh? So, after you've given up your throne and getting ready for a life without a crown, what are you left with? What are you ready for? And ablution, our third ab word. So what's an ablution? Ablution is a noun referring to the washing of one's body, or part of it, especially as a religious ritual. Let's take a look at ablution. There's our trusty Latin prefix ab, meaning offer away. And the second part of ablution comes from the Latin verb luo, meaning wash. So, ab just intensifies that meaning and suggests purifying yourself by washing grime and dirt off of your body, or maybe even washing a sin off of your soul. And I'm glad we are at ablution now, because with all this ab work we've been doing, we need a break. So let's examine the lu in ablution a little further. As I just noted, it's from the Latin verb luo, meaning wash. So English words that contain the L-U root often have something to do with washing. Write that down in your vocabulary notebook. And let's look at two great lu words, deluge and antediluvian. Deluge will be our key word for lu, and antediluvian will be our target word. Now, a deluge is a torrential downpour, a great flood of water that washes things away. So write down deluge as your keyword for the L-U root in your vocabulary notebook. Highlight the L-U and write that when you experience a deluge, things get washed away. So now, deluge is a great word we probably all know. But how is deluge related to our target word, antediluvian? Well, antediluvian was a word originally coined by Sir Thomas Brown in the 1600s by combining the Latin preposition ante, meaning before, with the Latin noun diluvium, meaning deluge or flood. So originally, antediluvian was an adjective meaning of or relating to the period before the biblical flood. Yes, that biblical flood with Noah and all the animals and his ark. And you'll still encounter this before the flood sense of antediluvian. However, by the 1700s, antediluvian took on a second sense as an adjective meaning very old and out of fashion, out of date, antiquated, primitive. And you'll probably see the second sense of antediluvian more often, as in, because of the company's antediluvian views on social media and the internet, they lost the opportunity to market their products to 18 to 35-year-olds. That's a wonderfully useful word, don't you think? I mean, how many old-fashioned, out-of-date ideas do we encounter every day? So I want you to think of someone or something that you think is old-fashioned, out-of-date, or primitive. Maybe it's your parents' antediluvian attitude towards staying out late. Or maybe it's a politician's antediluvian views on some issue. Write this down in your vocabulary notebook as an example of antediluvian. And by the way, while we're on the subject of washing things, there's another root spelled L-A-U or L-A-V that also means wash. And you'll see it in words like laundry, launder, and lavatory. Okay, let's return to our three ab verbs and sum up. Ab means away or off. And abdicate is to renounce the throne, etymologically to speak it away. Abnegate means to renounce or deny away. And ablution is a noun that involves washing dirt or impurity away. But I have one more ab word for you, and it's my favorite. Absquatulate. Just say it with me three times. Absquatulate, absquatulate, absquatulate. Just plain fun to say, isn't it? So if you absquatulate, have you done something heinous or disgusting? Actually, you might have. And before I tell you the definition, let's break absquatulate down by its morphemes. What word or word parts do you see that pop out at you? Well, if you take off the ab prefix, what are you left with? Squatulate. Do you see a word in squatulate that you already know? I know what you're thinking. Don't be shy. Go ahead and say it. If you said squat, you would be absolutely correct. Absquatulate is a verb that means to flee, abscond, and it combines ab, meaning away off, and squat, meaning to crouch down. So I want you to visualize someone squatting and crouching down. Okay, you got it? And then when you add the ab prefix, visualize them quickly popping up and taking off and running away. to quickly run away, usually having stolen something. That's absquatulate, as in the following sentence. When we returned to our campsite, we realized the other hiker had absquatulated with most of our gear. So if you're in a squat and decide to leave or to go off or away, quickly you've absquatulated. Absquatulate is often used to mean not just taking off, but absconding with something. Now admittedly, absquatulate never really took off, as mostly used as a pretty silly sounding word. So where did this silly sounding word come from? Well, again, according to vocabulary.com, absquatulate was an Americanism coined in the 1830s out of a mock Latin negation of squat. And it came out of, get this, a crazy fad for creating Latin-sounding words that were playful and snappy. Now, you may be thinking, that's great for a bunch of word nerds to sit around and make up words like this, Kevin, but so what? Well, two other words from that 19th century fad did make it big, or at least big enough to still be used today. First, bloviate, to speak pompously. Remember the bloviating blowhards from our lecture on false pride? Bloviate is based on the word blow. And the second, discombobulate. Now, discombobulate is a verb meaning to confuse, upset, or frustrate. My youngest daughter, Claire, is a word nerd in the making. And when she came to me with her list of her favorite sounding words, discombobulate was number one on the list. And I think she's right. Discombobulate. It just sounds confusing, doesn't it? Okay, now so far in this lecture, we focused on two Latin prefixes, d and ab, and a fertile Latin root, lu, meaning wash. Now remember, a root gives us the core meaning of a word. For example, the lu in deluge carries the central meaning of wash. And the prefix de modifies this core meaning by adding the meaning of away to wash. So a deluge will, etymologically speaking, wash things away. Okay, so if a root or base word gives us the core meaning of a word, and if a prefix modifies or augments this word, what do suffixes do? Well, suffixes often determine the part of speech of a word. For example, if you take the adjective civil, meaning courteous, and add the suffix ize, you change the adjective to a verb, civil, civilize, meaning to bring out of a rude state, to enlighten, refine. From the adjective civil to the verb civilize. That's what suffixes can do. Now, with this role of suffixes in mind, let's explore one high-utility suffix pair, ism and ist. Okay, here we go. Rationalism, empiricism, materialism, behaviorism, existentialist, logical positivist. Woo! There are a lot of isms and ists out there. But don't worry. We are not headed for a deep philosophical discussion in these last few minutes. We're going to briefly tackle just four isms. Two of them you probably are already familiar with, agnosticism and atheism. But since you may not be as familiar with the other two, we'll make them our target words, nihilism and solipsism. The ism in each of these words is derived from the Greek suffix ismos. And like its Greek source, ism is a noun-forming suffix that can refer to a condition or a theory, belief system, or doctrine, as in capitalism, socialism, and communism. And there's a related suffix, ist, which you'll see in the words atheist, nihilist, and solipsist. The ist in such words is from the Greek suffix istes, which is an agent-forming suffix. So ist can signify one who does or makes, like a chemist. It can also be used to indicate one who adheres to a certain doctrine or belief, in words like capitalist, socialist, and communist. So a capitalist is one who believes in capitalism. So write these meanings for ism and ist down in your vocabulary notebook. So let's quickly look at the words atheism and agnosticism, two isms that are commonly confused. Agnosticism is a noun referring to the view that we do not know or cannot know whether or not a deity exists. We cannot prove it either way. Now, atheism, in contrast, is the belief that there is no God. Atheism comes from the Greek prefix a, meaning not or without, and the Greek noun theos, meaning God. Now, the word agnostic was first coined in 1869 by the English biologist T.H. Huxley. And he combined the Greek prefix a with the root gnostic, which comes from the Greek noun gnosis, meaning knowledge. So, an agnostic believes that we cannot have knowledge of a deity's existence. Okay, so in sum, an atheist believes that there is no God, while an agnostic isn't sure about God's existence because we can't prove it either way. Okay, now let's move on to our two ism target words, nihilism and solipsism. Nihilism comes from the Latin nihil, meaning nothing. To remember this, you may have heard soccer fans use a related word to refer to a match in which neither team scores as ending 0-0, 0-0, no goals scored, a boring match with nothing. So nihilism is a noun that means a belief in nothing. And in philosophy, nihilism refers to the complete rejection of religious beliefs and moral values. Now, how about solipsism? Well, solipsism was coined in 1871 from two Latin words, solus, meaning alone, and ipse, meaning self. So, solipsism is a noun that has two basic meanings. First, it can refer to a philosophy that one has no valid reason for believing that anything exists except oneself. And second, and more commonly, solipsism is used in a negative sense to refer to an extreme preoccupation with one's own feelings and own thoughts. So, a solipsist would be an extremely egocentric person, someone who's always focusing on him or herself. And with this complete focus on one's self-sense of solipsism in mind, I want to tell you a solipsistic joke. Did you hear about the solipsist who broke up with her boyfriend? When he asked why she was breaking up with him, she said, "It's not you, it's me." Nothing like some philosophical humor to bring us to our final target word of the day, protean. Now, protean doesn't involve any of the roots and affixes that we discussed today, but I think its meaning sheds some light on the importance of studying roots and affixes in general. So what do you think protean means? Do you think it means A, first or foremost, or B, changeable? Well, protean comes from Proteus, a sea god in Greek mythology. And in various accounts, he is either Poseidon's first son or his attendant. Now, Proteus had a pretty useful power. He was prescient. He could foretell the future. But he didn't want to tell a future to just anyone. You had to catch him to make him tell you the truth. And catching Proteus was not easy. You see, Proteus could change shape. And in one account, when asked a question he really did not want to answer, he changed shape into a lion, a serpent, a leopard, a bear, liquid water, and then a tree in an effort to get away. That's a lot of mutating, isn't it? And that brings us back to the meaning of protean. Did you say protean meant A, first or foremost, or B, changeable? If you said B, changeable, you were right. Protean is an adjective meaning able to take many forms or do many different things. Versatile. You'll hear of a protean genius like Picasso, who is constantly experimenting and changing how he worked throughout his career. Or you might hear of a protean actor who is versatile and can play many different parts. For this sense of protean, I think of one of the great actresses of all time, Meryl Streep. She can play both dramatic and comedic roles and is well known for her ability to do many accents. So make a personal connection to protean. Think of someone or something you know that's constantly changing or that has taken on many forms over the course of time. Write this down in your vocabulary notebook as an example of protean. And this idea of protean versatility is a fantastic idea to end our Roots lecture on. Now remember, our language is constantly changing, constantly evolving, including adding new words all the time. And one of the primary ways English adds words is by forming new words from Latin and Greek affixes, roots, and base words. So, when we take the time to learn about the roots of English like we did today, we actually are developing our own linguistic versatility.
Lecture 22, Cranky Words and Cool Words.
Let's start today's lecture on cranky and cool words with some cranky quotes from the great Mark Twain, who chronicled human hypocrisy and foibles with wit and sarcasm. I did not attend his funeral, but I sent a nice letter saying I approved of it. A lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. Reader, suppose you were an idiot. And suppose you were a member of Congress. But I repeat myself. A clear conscience is the sure sign of a bad memory. And perhaps the crankiest quote of all, the more I learn about people, the more I like my dog. Now, while Twain was certainly known for his sarcasm, there was always an undercurrent of warmth and humanity in his writing. However, in our own lives, we deal with cranky, crabby folks who don't always share Twain's tempering warmth. It seems these ornery, irascible, crotchety, cantankerous curmudgeons can't control their negative emotions. And we also deal with a category of folks on the opposite end of the emotional spectrum, those who seem to have no emotion at all, the cool and reserved, those thick-skinned, unemotional, distant, detached, dispassionate, icy, heartless, cold-hearted, cold-blooded, cold fish. Well, English has a host of wonderful words for both these types, both the cranky and the cool. So let's dig in. For our first target word, I want to bring you back to my childhood. Now, for much of my childhood, I grew up in a suburban neighborhood outside of Washington, D.C. in Northern Virginia. Our neighborhood was jam-packed with families, and there were children of all ages in just about every house. My siblings and I were nearly always found out playing, pick up soccer, basketball, swimming, goofing around at our friends' houses, or playing flashlight tag during the warm summer nights. Now, one of our friends, Sammy, had the best yard for playing almost any game or sport. It was big, flat, and devoid of trees and bushes. However, there was one catch. Miss Green. Miss Green was a cantankerous older lady who lived alone right next to Sammy's house. While playing in Sammy's yard, we'd often see Miss Green's nose and one eye peering out from behind the curtains of the upstairs side window. Try as we might to keep the various footballs, soccer balls, tennis balls, baseballs, and frisbees in Sammy's yard, inevitably, a ball would end up over at Miss Green's. And if that happened, all bets were off. In a flash, Miss Green would be out on the front porch, ready and staring at us. Sometimes she'd just give us the evil eye. Other times she'd yell and scream, calling us hoodlums and hooligans. And when she was really feeling irritable, our favorite moniker, Little Piss Ants. Now sometimes she'd come out, pick up our ball, and with a smug smile of pure spite, walk right back inside with it. If we even looked like we were going to make a break for the ball in her yard, she'd threaten to call the police and get us thrown in juvenile detention for trespassing. So Miss Green is a perfect example of our first target word, splenetic. Splenetic is an adjective meaning bad-tempered, irritable, or spiteful. A splenetic person can also be morose, sullen, and full of peevish anger. Just the kind of person you want to spend some time with, huh? Your splenetic professor is the one who's so bristly and prickly, you're afraid to ask a question in class for fear of igniting her temper and receiving a cutting, sarcastic jab in response. Your splenetic boss flies into a rage at the slightest provocation. Your splenetic cousin is the one who makes sarcastic comments about your sweet potato pie at Thanksgiving. So put simply, splenetic folks are ill-tempered cranks. Let's put splenetic in context. His blog is chock full of splenetic attacks on any politician who doesn't completely agree with him. No wonder he's called the angriest man in politics. Now, being an adult with my own children, I think of Miss Green from time to time. And there is definitely a part of me that sympathizes. She may have been a lonely person who was a bit frightened of all these groups of kids. However, she was still splenetic. Now, when you look at or hear the word splenetic, does it remind you of another word you know? How about spleen? Splenetic is actually related to that organ. The spleen was considered the seat of moroseness and bad temper in medieval physiology. So, an important organ in our body gave birth to our target word. I mean, you can't make that stuff up. So to remember the meaning of splenetic, connect it to spleen. Now, I remember it this way. If I had a splinter in my spleen, I'd be splenetic, irritable and spiteful. Wouldn't you? Splinter, spleen, splenetic. Write this connection down in your vocabulary notebook to help you remember the word. Now, I want you to think of someone you may have known when you were a kid. Someone like Miss Green who was irritable, bad-tempered, and spiteful. Write their name down in your vocabulary notebook next to splenetic. Some great synonyms for splenetic include two short, punchy, lively ones I love, but don't think we use enough. Bristly and prickly. And don't forget some other great standbys. Crabby, cranky, crotchety, and cantankerous. Those words just sound irritated, don't they? And here are a few others. Use irascible to describe someone who flies off the handle at the slightest provocation. Use testy to suggest someone who easily gets irritated by small annoyances. And then there's the wonderful word dyspeptic, meaning gloomy, sullen, and irritable. Okay, for our next target word, I'm going to share a story from my wife's Uncle Joe that has become a staple in our family lore. Now, back when Uncle Joe was in high school in the 1950s, the style among the guys was to wear your white Hanes t-shirt as your main shirt. Joe's mom didn't like this at all. She thought wearing just your t-shirt was like wearing your underwear out in public. So, she made sure Joe was wearing a collared shirt over his t-shirt before he left for school every morning. However, Joe, being a bit unruly, wasn't going for it. So Joe had devised a system to circumvent his mother's morning sartorial inspections. He hung a hanger in the bushes outside the house. After he left the house in the morning, he'd take off his collared shirt, hang it up neatly on the hanger in the bushes, and go to school just in his t-shirt. And after school, before he came home, he'd go to the bushes, retrieve the still neat shirt, and put it on before walking back in the door. So one day, Joe came home and, as usual, went to the bush before entering the house. The hanger was there all right, but his shirt wasn't. Joe's mom had found him out. But this didn't stop Joe. One night, he had a bunch of his friends over for dinner. It was really hot, so Joe and his friends took off their letter jackets, leaving just their t-shirts on. Well, this was the last straw for Joe's mom. And what she did next was worse than any punishment I've ever heard of before or since. And to understand this punishment, you need to know that Joe's mother was the most elegant, gracious, proper, and polished-looking lady you could ever meet. With Joe and his friends sitting down for dinner, Joe's mom came down the steps and sat down. Everyone's jaws dropped. Joe's friends, and especially Joe, whose face flushed with embarrassment. You see, Joe's mom had come down to dinner wearing only her slip. Can you imagine eating dinner with your best friends while your mother is in her undergarments right across the table? The point was made. If you're going to wear your underwear in the house and embarrass the family, so will I. So as you can imagine, this story has gone down in our family lore and is retold at family gatherings. And this brings us to our next target word, fractious. Fractious is an adjective meaning unruly, hard to manage, rebellious. Now, Joe is not a fractious person, but his refusal to follow his mom's dress code was a bit fractious, a bit rebellious. We've all been a bit fractious at some point in our lives. Truly fractious folks always seem to be stirring up trouble and causing difficulties wherever they go. They could be cranky, peevish, and irritable, like splenetic folks, but it's their disobedience or opposition to established authority that differentiates the fractious from the splenetic. Think of that person at work who is so difficult for the boss to manage. He's constantly questioning management's decisions and bumping right up against the rules and regulations. Or think of that quarrelsome, contrary student you have class with, who's always questioning the professor's assignments and seems to love bringing up opposing points of view. Not because she really believes in them, oh no, but just to be ornery. You know the type? They hate being under someone else's thumb, and they seem to invite controversy and discord wherever they go. That's fractious. You'll also hear the word fractious used to describe troublesome, difficult relationships, as in, it took years for the son to overcome the fractious relationship he had with his father as a teenager. Now, as a side note, fractious is close in meaning to one of our target words from an earlier lecture, contumacious, an adjective meaning stubbornly rebellious, willfully and obstinately disobedient. Fractious and contumacious. Make that connection in your vocabulary notebook. Now, do you see a word part in fractious that jumps out at you? How about fract? Fract is a root derived from the Latin verb frango, meaning to break. To remember the root fract, our key word will be fracture, a broken bone, a break. Fractious people are not afraid to break rules and break up quiet meetings and break relationships. They're unruly and hard to manage. In your vocabulary notebook, highlight the fract in fractious and relate it to fracture so that you can remember this connection. Now, you'll also see fract in words like fraction, a whole thing broken into parts, and infraction, a breaking of the rules. And you'll see this root in a synonym for fractious, refractory, which means stubbornly disobedient, hard or difficult to manage. From one root, fract, we get fracture, fraction, infraction, fractious, and refractory, all sharing the core meaning of break. There's that root power again. One root can be the key to unlocking so many word meanings. And before we move on, you might want to connect the root fract in your vocabulary notebook with another root that we've already learned that also means break. Rupt, as in our key word rupture, disruption, and erupt. Fract and rupt, both roots meaning break. Okay, for our next target word, we're going to stick around these fractious, splenetic curmudgeons for a bit longer. In fact, this next target word could describe the way that splenetic curmudgeons talk to each other, with asperity. Asperity is an adjective meaning roughness or harshness of surface, sound, climate, condition, manner, or temper. So, asperity can mean harsh and rough both literally, as in the asperity of cruel Siberian winters, or figuratively, as in someone's harsh manner. Now, asperity is often used to describe a sound or voice, as in, whenever the children heard the note of asperity in their father's growl, they knew it was time to stop fooling around. Now, for asperity, I think of my father-in-law and some of the harsh conditions he experienced growing up in Depression-era South Dakota. One time, the family tried to outrun a dust storm in their car to get home, but they didn't make it. As my father-in-law's brother Bob told it, the cloud overtook us and day turned to night. Dad drove more by feel than by sight, and we finally pulled into the yard and were hustled into the house with kids crying and in great panic. Another time, my wife's aunt was hanging clothes on the line while a host of grasshoppers were eating all the crops, just like an Old Testament plague. And afterwards, when she returned to gather the clothes, not only were the crops eaten, but all the clothes were eaten, except for the rubber elastics from the woman's bloomers. Now, those are some pretty harsh conditions. The asperities my father-in-law and his family dealt with make many of our modern complaints feel a bit ridiculous, don't they? Now, asperity comes from the Latin word asper, meaning rough or harsh, and was used in Latin to describe sour wine, bad weather, and hard times. Sour wine, bad weather, and hard times. Sounds like the title of a country song, doesn't it? One that Willie Nelson, with his harsh, raspy, rough voice, might sing. Now, what other words do you know that contain the Latin word asper, meaning rough or harsh? Now, this one's a bit difficult. I'll give you a hint. For the related word that I'm thinking of, asper, asper, is actually in the middle of the word. The related word is exasperate. Exasperate. EX is a prefix usually meaning out of, as an export to carry out of. However, in exasperate, EX has the connotation of completely, thoroughly. And we know that asper means rough or harsh. So, if you're exasperated, you've been treated with complete and total harshness. Ouch! When you've been treated harshly, how do you feel? Exasperated, out of patience and annoyed and frustrated. Okay, so to remember asperity, highlight the asper word part in your vocabulary notebook and relate it to exasperate. Write down that when you are treated with asperity, rough and harsh treatment, you will become exasperated. Our fourth and final word in this cranky section of our lecture is importune. Now, what do you think importune means? It sounds a little like a combination of important and a tune, as in the notes to a really important song, right? But it's got nothing to do with that. Actually, importune is a verb meaning to harass with repeated requests, to demand of someone insistently. When someone importunes you, they're begging you for something persistently, urgently, and repeatedly. They're nagging and nagging and nagging you to the point of annoyance. They just won't stop. If someone importunes you for too long, you become cranky. Now, importune is a really useful word in today's world of telemarketers, mass email ads, and other means of demanding more and more of our time and money. Now, when I think of importune, I think of two things, my son and his cell phone. Or should I say his four cell phones? That's right. Now, Jack is a great kid with a big heart, and we love him. But he'd be the first to tell you that organization is not his thing. Jack has lost four cell phones and is now begging us, pleading with us, importuning us for a fifth cell phone. He won't stop. He dropped his first cell phone on the ground. Now, it didn't shatter on the outside, but something inside of it broke. He pleaded with us to get a new one, but we waited until our plan let us get a free one. We stuck to our guns. Then he lost his second cell phone, and we never found it. We refused to get another one again until our plan allowed a free one. He kept importuning us to buy him a new one. We held fast to our convictions. Barely. He dropped his third cell phone in the toilet. Don't ask. He did retrieve it. We did not ask how, but to no avail. It was completely kaput. The importuning, the nagging began again. He beseeched us to buy another. He implored us. He did everything but get down on his hands and knees. But we waited until the new plan kicked in again. The fourth one was left in a soccer bag during a soccer practice that was rained out. It was drenched. And this time, he really laid it on thick. It was a truly professional job of importuning. He began badgering us for a new phone again, and treating us to think of what it would be like to be a teenager without instant communication. He badgered, besieged, hounded, and harassed us. He called upon us in supplication. He pestered, plagued, and pleaded. And so far, we've held out against his importuning. But only just. So to remember importune, think of a time that someone has demanded something from you, harassing you with repeated requests. Maybe it was a son or daughter asking to borrow the car, and they just won't give up. Or maybe it was a sibling when you were younger, asking to play with a new toy. Or maybe it was your spouse asking, pleading, begging you to switch dinners at a restaurant after he or she realized that you ordered the best thing on the menu, and they didn't. Or maybe it was you doing the importuning. Write this example of importune down in your vocabulary notebook. Okay, we've explored the cranky side of life with splenetic, fractious, asperity, and importune. Woo, it's been an emotional first half of this lecture, hasn't it? Okay, well, take a deep breath and let all of your emotions out, because now we're moving to the other side of the emotional continuum, to folks that don't show much emotion, to the cool. Now, I don't mean cool as in Elvis Presley cool, but cool as in reserved, unemotional, the opposite of wearing your heart on your sleeve. We're moving to the land of the cold fish and the ice queens. Live long and prosper. Now, when I say this phrase, you probably think of Star Trek, the influential science fiction TV show, and one of its most famous characters, Mr. Spock. Spock was Captain Kirk's first officer on the starship Enterprise. And if you remember, Spock was also half Vulcan, those extraterrestrial humanoids who seemed like living, breathing computers. Spock lived by logic and reason, suppressing all emotion. And being Vulcan, Spock always offered the outsider's perspective on the human condition, saying things like, "This is highly illogical, Captain." So, Spock brings us to our next target word, phlegmatic. Phlegmatic is an adjective meaning showing little emotion, not easily excited to action. So unemotional. Huh, this could be both a positive and a negative attribute in a person, right? And like a number of words, phlegmatic can be used in both a positive or a negative sense. So in a positive sense, phlegmatic can mean self-possessed, calm, composed. These are good traits to have. Like, the phlegmatic firefighters were completely unruffled during the harrowing rescue. Their unflappable demeanor saved the day. Or, phlegmatic can be used in a negative sense. I mean, unemotional can be a bad thing, right? This pejorative sense of phlegmatic means cold, apathetic, sluggish. Her passionate plea got nothing but a phlegmatic shrug from her teenage son. So the next time you encounter phlegmatic, read the context closely to figure out which sense of unemotional, calm and composed, or cold and apathetic, is intended by the author. Now, let's use the related words strategy to help us store phlegmatic in our lexicon. Is there a related word that you already know that looks like it might be related to phlegmatic? If you said phlegm, you're right on target. You didn't blow it. Sorry, I couldn't help myself there. I just have a nose for bad puns. So what does phlegm, your mucus, have to do with being unemotional? Well, believe it or not, in ancient and medieval medicine, phlegm was considered to be one of the four humors of the body that needed to be in balance to sustain health. The others were black bile and yellow bile and blood. So are you enjoying phlegmatic yet? Now, phlegm was thought to cause apathy. So, if you were really cold and unemotional, then medieval doctors thought you had an imbalance of this humor. You had too much phlegm, hence the word phlegmatic. Now, you can remember phlegmatic in two ways. Write down whichever one works for you in your vocabulary notebook. First, when you've got a really bad cold, you've got a lot of phlegm, and you feel sluggish and apathetic. Phlegmatic, phlegm, cold, sluggish, and apathetic. Now here's a second way to remember phlegmatic. Think of Mr. Spock with a really bad cold, with a lot of phlegm. An unemotional Vulcan with a lot of phlegm. That's quite a gross visual, but if it helps you remember phlegmatic, use it. Okay, our next target word, stoic, is a close synonym to phlegmatic. However, there is a fine distinction between these two words. Stoic is an adjective that means seemingly indifferent to or unaffected by joy, grief, pleasure, or pain. This seems very close to phlegmatic, which means unemotional, right? So what's the difference in connotation between phlegmatic and stoic? According to the Merriam-Webster's Dictionary of Synonyms, phlegmatic implies a temperament or constitution in which emotion is hard to arouse. So phlegmatic suggests that you are naturally unemotional. It's your personality. It's in your DNA, kind of like a Vulcan. You were just born a cold fish. However, Stoic frequently suggests that through self-discipline and as a matter of principle, you are able to firmly restrain your responses to pain or distress. You've trained yourself to suppress pain and emotion, like an experienced boxer or wrestler who feels the pain but doesn't show it. That's Stoic, an unflinching fortitude in holding back your emotions. If you're Stoic, you're calm and austere under duress. Some examples of Stoic in context. The mountain man showed a Stoic indifference to hunger and cold. Or, the newly immigrated family was resolutely Stoic in the face of adversity. Now, you'll also encounter Stoic used as a noun to refer to one who is indifferent to pleasure or pain. The adjective Stoic comes from Stoicism, a radical philosophy founded and taught by Zeno in Athens about 300 BCE. Now, Zeno taught that happiness could be attained by one's use of reason and by repressing emotion and becoming indifferent to pleasure and pain. And the word Stoicism came from Stoa Poikile, the painted porch, which was a colonnaded portico in the agora of ancient Athens. It was inside this portico, this Stoa, that Zeno first taught his philosophy. Okay, our next target word has two things in common with Stoic. It shares the general meaning of unemotional, and it also starts with S-T-O. It's stolid. Now, stolid is an adjective meaning having or expressing little or no sensibility, unemotional. So, stolid, like phlegmatic and Stoic, carries the general meaning of being unresponsive to something that would normally excite or interest you. Now, we've already discussed the differences in meaning between phlegmatic and Stoic. So what about stolid? According to Merriam-Webster's Dictionary of Synonyms, stolid implies heavy, dull, obtuse, impassivity, or apathy, and suggests impassive, mechanical, plodding, unquestioning adherence to routine. So stolid is not just unemotional. It's that unemotional worker at the Department of Motor Vehicles, you know, who is dull and plodding and seems to have no personality or interest in anyone or anything beyond you filling out the correct form after having stood in line for 2 hours. That's stolid. And for our final target word, think back to those Stoic, self-disciplined folks we discussed earlier. How do Stoics become that way? How are they able to suppress their emotions and become accustomed to hardship and privation? Well, we've got just the right verb for these Stoics, inure. For inure, I want you to imagine a monk, a hermit who lives in a cave out in the desert wilderness. All he's got are a robe, a single blanket, and a few odds and ends. He eats roots and honey, only sleeps a few hours a night because he's meditating and praying most of the time, and doesn't even allow himself a fire except on bitterly cold nights. He's an ascetic, a person who for religious reasons practices incredible self-denial. But how can one continue to live such an austere life of rigorous abstinence? Wouldn't it get to you after a while? Well, this Stoic hermit has become so accustomed to these difficult conditions, he's become hardened, as tough as an old piece of leather. And this leads us to our next target word, inure, a verb that means to become accustomed to something undesirable, such as hardship, difficulty, or pain, to toughen or harden, to habituate. Inure is usually followed by the collocate to, as in, living in the wild for 30 years, the Stoic hermit became inured to cold and want. Or, many believe today's TV and video games have inured children to violence. And that ends our journey into the cranky and the cool. So, if you meet a crank or a cold fish in the near future, try one of these words out. If it's a crank, you might try out splenetic and fractious when they're not around. They're liable to get a bit touchy. If it's a cold fish, you can probably call them phlegmatic right to their faces. I mean, they won't care, right?
Lecture 23, Words for Courage and Cowardice.
Screw your courage to the sticking place. Shakespeare's famous line comes from Act 1, Scene 7 of Macbeth. In this scene, Lady Macbeth has been goading her husband on to murder King Duncan. But Macbeth is still a bit timid, a bit unsure about their plan. If we should fail, he asks. We fail, Lady Macbeth scoffs. But screw your courage to the sticking place, and we'll not fail. Now, in this lecture, we'll explore words associated with courage and cowardice. Now, the word courage itself is derived from the Latin root commonly spelled C-O-R or C-O-R-D, meaning heart. To fight with all your heart is to fight with great courage. Richard I of England was known as Richard the Lionheart, or Richard Cœur de Lion. Cœur being the French word derived from the Latin, cor. Now the Latin root, C-O-R, or C-O-R-D, is found in many derived English words, including core. The core of an apple is its middle, its heart. And cordial, warm and friendly, or warming or stimulating, like a liqueur. It is also the root for discourage and encourage, discord and concord. So what does it mean to screw your courage to the sticking place? According to the editors of the Riverside Shakespeare, a sticking place is the mark to which a soldier screwed up the cord of a crossbow. The Oxford English Dictionary, though, suggests that a sticking place is the point at which a tuning peg on a stringed instrument is fixed tightly when screwed in. Either way, when you're screwing your courage to the sticking place, you're winding or coiling your courage up, getting ready to unleash it. Lady Macbeth is telling her husband to gird up his loins, stop being a milksop, and to get stabbing. For the first part of today's lecture, we're going to explore some powerful words for different kinds of courage, including false courage, cheeky courage, and reckless courage. So let's get started. For our first two target words, I'm going to bring you back to the early life of one of the most courageous figures in American history, Frederick Douglass. Now, after escaping slavery, Frederick Douglass became one of the great leaders in the abolitionist movement, a social reformer, a writer, and a statesman. He was known for his brilliant oratory and trenchant anti-slavery writing, including his autobiography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, one of the most powerful books that I've ever read. Now, I'm a literacy educator. I've spent 2 decades working to try and improve the literacy skills of children and adolescents who struggle to read and write. So one thing that astounds me about Frederick Douglass is that he learned to read and write by himself, with no teacher. And even more incredible, he had to teach himself to read secretly at a time when it was against the law to teach enslaved people to read. Douglass tells it best himself. At this point in his autobiography, Douglass is 12 years old and living as an enslaved person in Baltimore. His new mistress tries to start teaching him a few short words, but her husband strictly forbids it. Douglass writes, "From that moment, I understood the pathway from slavery to freedom. It was just what I wanted, and I got it at a time when I the least expected it." Now Douglass continues, "Though conscious of the difficulty of learning without a teacher, I set out with high hope and a fixed purpose, at whatever cost of trouble, to learn how to read." Douglass knew the power of the written word to free your heart, free your soul, and free your mind. And he wasn't going to let anything stop him from attaining it. Douglass had to be courageous and smart. he made friends with a number of the white boys that he met in the streets of Baltimore. Now, Douglas reports that he always had enough bread while in Baltimore. However, the boys he befriended were poor and hungry, but they could read. So, he traded his bread for, as he so eloquently puts it, their more valuable bread of knowledge. Bread for words. Now, to learn how to write, Douglas was just as ingenious. In the Baltimore shipyards, he would carefully watch the ship carpenters write on the timber the name of that part of the ship for which it was intended. For example, he might see the carpenter write the letters S-A to indicate that the piece was for the starboard aft. Now, Douglas would immediately copy the letters the way he had seen the carpenters form them until he was certain he could write them himself. Again, Douglas tells it best. After a time, when I met with any boy who I knew could write, I would tell him I could write as well as he. The next word would be, "I don't believe you. Let me see you try it." I would then make the letters which I had been so fortunate as to learn and ask him to beat that. In this way, I got a good many lessons in writing, which it is quite possible I should never have gotten in any other way. And Douglas concludes the chapter saying, "Thus, after a long, tedious effort for years, I finally succeeded in learning how to write." This brings us to our first two target words, two words related to courage that Douglas exemplifies, intrepid and fortitude. Now, intrepid is close to courageous, but not its exact synonym. And fortitude is close to courage, but not its exact synonym. Let's delve into the finer shades of meaning. Intrepid is an adjective meaning resolutely fearless, dauntless. You hear of intrepid explorers who go off into the wild, uncharted lands. Intrepid suggests either daring in the face of danger, or, and here's the important difference in connotation, a fortitude in enduring it. So, if you are intrepid, you're showing courage that endures. Courage over the long haul. And fortitude is a noun referring to mental and emotional strength in facing difficulty, adversity, danger, or temptation courageously. According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of Synonyms, the noun fortitude suggests a prolonged endurance of physical or mental hardships without giving way under the strain. Prolonged endurance through suffering without giving up. In other words, fortitude isn't just another noun for courage. It often implies courage and stick-to-itiveness over the long haul. Not giving up, not giving in, even when you're knocked down, time and time again. Someone who can do that is intrepid. They've got fortitude, just like Frederick Douglass. Now, intrepid comes from the Latin in, meaning not, plus trepidus, an adjective that means alarmed, scared. Now, trepidus is related to the Latin verb trepido, meaning tremble. So, to be intrepid is to not be alarmed or scared, to not tremble, even in the face of danger. So in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the in, meaning not, and the trepid, meaning tremble, to help you remember this word. From trepidus, we also get trepidation, trembling or tremulous fear. Another wonderful synonym for intrepid is undaunted. Now, use undaunted when you want to describe the type of person who keeps picking themselves up with courage and firm resolve after defeat and hardship. Undaunted Courage is a best-selling account of the Lewis and Clark expedition written by historian Stephen Ambrose. Okay, next up is one of Flanagan's favorites. It's a bit informal, but that doesn't make it any less of a word. It's moxie. If a freshman quarterback comes into a football game, and despite constantly getting knocked down and sacked by the older, bigger players, keeps getting up again and again, the coach might say, "That kid's got moxie." Moxie is a noun referring to the ability to face difficulty with spirit and courage. If you've got moxie, you've got nerve, grit, sand, pluck, backbone, and guts all rolled into one. You're full of metal and gumption. Moxie is like the little brother to courage, a plucky, spunky, scrappy little brother who's got attitude and fighting spirit. Moxie's another one of those words that sounds like what it means. Moxie. Now, moxie can also refer to aggressive energy, vigor, verve, and pep, or skill and know-how. So, where did the word moxie come from? Well, moxie was originally the brand name of a non-alcoholic bitter drink sold in the late 1800s.